Hey everyone, we have Matt Dillahunty tomorrow. This is Jason Fry, President of the Humanist Association, and you're listening to the San Diego Seculars for Friday, January 11th, 2013. Hey everybody, I hope that you enjoyed our last one. So I'm sort of on a kick now of podcasting every week. It might be kind of choppy at first, mainly because there's a lot happening right now. I'm going to get to that in just a bit. But this is going to be our first actual San Diego Seculars rather than Secular. I am here with Chris Beezer. Chris, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great. How are you, Jason?
Good. Chris, this is your first podcast. We are popping your podcast virginal cherry.
Oh, boy.
There we go. So I want to go over what we talked about at Coffee and Conversation, and then I want to talk about the wonderful event that we have scheduled for everyone tomorrow on Saturday, January 12th. So let me get started real quick. I don't have time to edit, but everybody wants to hear these and wants me to get them out, so this is what you get. And after the Dillahunty event, everything's going to be back in line, and I'm going to have time again. And that's the one thing about being an organizer is – you're grateful for the opportunity to do something that makes someone happy, but you just can't long for that moment enough where you just say, okay, yes, thank you for coming, and then you can just collapse under your own, you know, hard work. But it's a lot of fun doing this, actually, and, you know, talking and meeting so many people and creating something, you know, thinking about something and manifesting it to make people happy, and I guess that's really what it's all about. So I guess we talked more about gun violence again this week because that's what everyone's talking about. So there were a lot of people, these crazy people who decided that since secession was all the rage a couple months ago during the election, and they had the whole White House petition to secede from the union, to consider seceding from the union. Now there's lots and lots more crazy White House petitions, one of which was from a bunch of gun nuts petitioning President Obama to consider deporting Piers Morgan for his anti-gun sentiments. And Piers Morgan, of course, came out saying he may deport himself if we don't change our crazy gun laws. Senator Dianne Feinstein is introducing a new firearms bill. Of course, she introduced the assault weapons, she introduced the assault weapon and large magazine ban of 1994 that expired in 2004. On top of that, the mother of one of the Sandy Hook students, this kid that wasn't in school that day, Little Logan Dreyer, apparently had a lot of psychological stress for weeks leading up to the shooting. And so the school psychologist said that Karen Dreyer could take her little darling out of school, and coping with the stress of the shooting, Karen Dreyer came out saying that her son Logan's quote-unquote psychic power saved him on the day of the shooting. On top of that, it also came out, and this thing bothers me a lot, because they always say things like this: well, you're more likely to die of a lightning strike than to be attacked by a shark. Well, if the potential to be attacked by a shark is still there, you should still try to minimize the shark attack. Well, there was talk that for the last quite a few years, according to violent crime statistics, more people are annually consistently murdered with blunt instruments, hammers and clubs, than firearms every single year. For example, last year there were 323 firearm deaths versus 496 blunt instruments. So I guess every year you are more likely to be killed by Mrs. Peacock in the conservatory with the candlestick than Colonel Mustard in the garage with the firearm, with the revolver. But still, pardon me, just because there are more hammer incidents, it doesn't mean that we can't work to minimize the amount of firearms incidents. On top of that, we talked about the Affordable Care Act and how the National Rifle Association inserted into Title 10 of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, a provision called Protection of Second Amendment Gun Rights. And in that, it does not disclose, it does not require doctors to disclose or collect information relating to the presence or storage of a lawfully possessed firearm or the use of a firearm. It also says doctors are prohibited from writing such information about their patients down, nor can they collect information of gun or ammo ownership that limits the ability of doctors and other medical professionals to determine rates of... Oh, sorry, this is for healthcare companies. I apologize. It limits healthcare companies from the ability to determine rates or eligibility based upon firearms ownership, even though no one can be turned down anymore based upon pre-existing conditions. But this about limiting eligibility for gun ownership, you know, to think about violence, that type of thing, preemptively. Also, it says gun owners who, they don't have to disclose that they own a weapon. And then lastly, this is interesting, there was an NRA-sponsored bill that passed in Florida a while back, but it was recently overturned by a judge, and that bill would have penalized doctors from asking patients about gun access or ownership. And this is just insane. I want to talk more about this probably later, maybe not, but I wanted just to tell you what we talked about. On top of that, it was New Year's Eve, you know, a little over a week ago, and it came out that two unrelated incidents. There was a Florida grandmother and an 8-year-old boy, another Floridian, who were the victims of celebratory gunfire. When people shoot guns off on New Year's Day, what tends to happen is they often forget or don't care that what goes up must also come down. Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I'm not a Nazi when it comes to regulating guns. I think people with proper training should be able to carry around firearms, maybe not necessarily concealed firearms, but we do still have to keep in mind that these weapons are objectively more lethal than other weapons like swords or blunt instruments, as we were talking about before. We need to take that into account.
Yeah, and this is sort of the problem of the ambiguous nature of certain portions of the Constitution, because they always say they always talk about the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but they never talk about the preemptive clause, which is a well-regulated militia necessary to the protection of the free state, you know, trying to cite this from memory, but they never talk about that, and it seems just so A, ambiguous, and B, poorly worded, you know, a necessary militia being a well-regulated militia being necessary to the protection of the free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay, well, it doesn't necessarily say, you know, connect those two. Those are two independent clauses, and it, you know, possibly connects them, but listen, topic for another day. On top of that, what else do we have on the schedule? This was really interesting. So out of Loyola University in New Orleans, there was a researcher, and this was published in the Journal of Social Psychology and Personality Science, but this researcher, Kendall Eskine, looked at the branding of organic foods. And what Eskine did is took 62 participants and had them look at images of foods labeled as organic, other images such as rice and beans, and other ones like comfort foods. And what Eskine found out is that those who were shown images of organic foods exhibited less pro-social behavior by being less likely to volunteer their time than people who looked at other types of food. And he also said that when the subjects were also asked if they would volunteer for a fictitious study, they didn't know it was fictitious, but a fictitious study on how much time they would offer to volunteer in this between 0 to 30 minutes. And this was to help a stranger. And those who had valued organic food highly or had been exposed, I forget which, who were more preferable or had been longer exposed to organic brand labeling would volunteer about 13 minutes. The control group, the rice and beans group, would volunteer 19, and the comfort food group would volunteer 24 minutes. And Eskine writes, the leading author, Kendall Eskine writes, "I'm an advocate for organic practices and regularly purchase such foods. While these foods are clearly the environmentally and ethically superior choices, what I'm concerned with is its marketing and how that marketing might influence people's subsequent behavior. My hope is that this research will provide an opportunity to encourage all kinds of eaters to engage in altruistic acts that extend beyond mere food purchases. And no, people who eat organic food are not jerks. My 18-month-old eats organic foods nearly exclusively, and he's awesome." And I think this is really interesting because one person cited in this talked about how they went to a farmer's market and it looked like a scene directly out of Portlandia. And it just seems as though, according to this study, that according to Eskine, that a lot of these products are marketed with quote-unquote moral language, such as honest tea. And Eskine writes, "People may feel like they've done their good deed, that they have permission or license to act unethically later on. It's like when you go to the gym and run a few miles and you feel good about yourself, so you eat a candy bar." And so I think this is just really interesting because at the same time, could it be people who are, you know, driven to be more judgmental, who are more driven by this, or does that labeling, that moralistic labeling, offer any type of, you know, drive to possibly become more judgmental? Maybe it's a social thing too, where it's socially enforced to be more judgmental towards those who are not actively pursuing these particularly quote-unquote socially conscious at a higher price policies. What are your thoughts, Chris?
Well, this study is mainly about ethics and behavior, but I want to note a couple things that the author said. While these foods are clearly the environmentally and ethically superior choices, you know, there was a lot of talk at Coffee and Conversation about organic foods themselves, even though that wasn't really, as you pointed out, Jason, what the study was about. But I think if an author makes such a blunt and confident statement like that, he should probably back it up. And also, his statement later on, my 18-month-old eats organic foods nearly exclusively and he's awesome. I'm just gonna assume that was a facetious statement, you know, just a joke.
I don't know. I don't know. Most every parent thinks their kids are awesome, except for the ones who think their kids are dumb.
Just yeah, kidding. But I don't think
excuse me,
18-month-olds generally are capable of being judgmental. So
yeah,
I'm just gonna take that as a facetious remark.
Yeah, that comes about the 24th month. Just kidding. But yeah, and I don't know, in our meeting when we talked about this, people who tended to favor organic, there was sort of interesting too, because there were people who were not impressed and quite antipathetical to this study, and then other people in the room, even if they were organic enthusiasts themselves, they commented on the judgmental nature and the self-righteous natures of mm-hmm. people who just go towards places like Whole Foods and co-ops and look at other people for not bringing their own bag. And, you know, I don't know. I think that this is an interesting idea about, you know, giving at the office, so to speak, when it comes to altruistic and ethical behavior. And so moving on to separation of church and state news, Hobby Lobby, which is owned by a Christian family which also owns Mardell Inc., a religious bookseller. Keep in mind, Hobby Lobby is also closed on Sunday, has about 13,000 employees, and they're owned by the same conservative Christian family. And they have announced that against potential fines of $1.3 million a day, they will defy the Affordable Care Act mandate on employers providing contraceptive options and healthcare coverage plans for employees. And it's interesting because this is being put out as conscience clauses. And, you know, at the moment, houses of worship can have a bit of leeway on this, but Hobby Lobby is not a house of worship. And according to Rob Boston of Americans United, he says companies seeking to make medical, these are nothing but companies seeking to make medical and moral decisions for their employees. And Hobby Lobby says that its goal is honoring the Lord in all that we do by operating the company in a manner consistent with biblical principles. And what's interesting about this is that they tried to appeal to the Supreme Court, and they went through the Tenth Circuit. And Sonia Sotomayor, an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, the one that handles emergency appeals from the Tenth Circuit, has denied Hobby Lobby's request for an injunction while the lawsuit is pending. And she says that the Justice Sotomayor says the claim has failed to meet the demanding standard for extraordinary relief in this case. And so I like this idea that if you do business in America, you're subject to certain regulations, for example, Child Labor Act regulations, and now finally this. And the fact of the matter is that this is not a church in and of itself, and if they're doing business in the United States, they should abide by regular labor laws that recognize the rights of individual citizens to make up their own damn mind. And that's really what this is about.
Oh, but that's not what they believe, Jason. See this statement, this goal statement that they made, it's very revealing. Honoring the Lord in all we do by operating the company in a manner consistent with biblical principles. You know, when people really, really believe in their religion, telling them to keep their religion separate from their politics is, that's just impossible for them.
Yeah, and it just strikes
beliefs inform actions, and if your beliefs tell you that this is the way that you are to behave, you are to behave in accordance with the Lord's commandments.
Yeah, well, one thing strikes me about this is a hobby is something that you do during your free time, your pastime. It's something that you have idle time for. And it's really interesting that, isn't this saying that idle fingers are the devil's playground?
And
this is a store that caters towards idle fingers. So there you go, devil's playground. So
and would you happen to know if Hobby Lobby is open on Sundays?
No, they're closed on Sundays.
Sundays. Okay. Uh-huh. Well, they're definitely doing a good job of staying with biblical principles then.
Yeah, and we talked about something similar to this about creationism in Kentucky, and the chair of the Kentucky Education Committee, or Science and Education Committee, said that though he was a creationist himself, that the state Senate's Education Committee said that though he was a creationist himself, he would not push creationism or allow the mention of creationism in science classrooms. Well, we have Indiana, which isn't terribly far from Kentucky, either geographically or, you know, intellectually. I'm just kidding. But in Indiana, there's a bad legislative bill, and Indiana State Senator, and who's also the Senate Education Chair, what is with this? Even in the United States House, we have Paul Brown on the Science Education Committee, and he's the one who said that evolution's a lie from the pit of hell or something like that. Anyway, so Indiana State Senator and Senate Education Chair Dennis Krause, Republican, introduced a new bill on the first day of the legislative session 2 weeks ago, saying that in order that each student recognize the importance of spiritual development in establishing character and becoming a good citizen, the governing body of a school or corporation or the equivalent authority of a charter school may require the recitation of the Lord's Prayer at the beginning of each school day. The prayer may be recited by a teacher, a student, or the class of students. And this one's already been decided by the Supreme Court. It won't pass. And one thing that I think about when people do this is they may be sincere, but at the same time, they're, you know, legislators can get a lot out of pushing a particular piece of legislation, sponsoring a particular piece of legislation, whether you're conservative or you're liberal, that you know won't pass, in order to say that you're standing at the vanguard of liberty and justice and right, and look at all those horrible people who are trying to trample on your rights and throw your own identity into the waste bin of history, and trying to not only exploit you but attack you, to throw your mother in jail and take away our guns. But look at me, I stood up and I was your one lone friend, your bastion of virtue. And so this is, it could go either way on that. If he's absolutely sincere, he could be sincere and doing that political capital move.
Yeah, and I want to repeat what I said at Coffee and Conversation on this subject. I think that people like this that are spreading these lies about morality and religion are enemies. They really are. They're basically saying that we secular people cannot be good without a God. They're saying the antithesis of the American Humanist Association's current slogan. And that's one of the primary issues that I think we're fighting against.
Yeah.
Well, in our, I guess, our ideological battle.
Yeah, well, these two things, just like you said, they seem absolutely unrelated. They're independent of each other, because he's not even talking about any type of appeal to spiritual morality. He's talking about one particular type of morality. And I don't know, you know, I'll talk about this at a later time, but I started reading the Gospels lately seriously. As a kid, I would occasionally skim through them with, you know, Midwest, everyone belongs to a church, shit like that. But I started seriously reading the Gospels recently, and I'm glad that I've read Aristotle, Plato, Kant, Rousseau, Locke, Rawls, all these philosophers, John Stuart Mill, Ingersoll, Russell, Voltaire, Freud, Nietzsche, Marx, you know, people before and after Christ, Muhammad, etc., etc. And now I think that I have a good benchmark for which to judge ethical behavior by, and good ideas. And, you know, I'm going to talk about this later, but I, at this point, I personally can't understand these deistic and secular thinkers throughout history even considering Jesus to be an ethical person. Actually, looking at this and looking at what we would otherwise consider good or evil, I think people pay far too much lip service to Jesus, and I personally think Christ is evil. I think Christ is evil, and I think it's said, you know, very well, and they'll say, oh, well, he magically, you know, put the ear back on the Roman soldier. He said, let he without sin cast the first stone. Well, number one, just doing one good act doesn't necessarily make you a good person when everything is put in the aggregate at the very end of your life. And also, this is just, you know, the character of Christ, because there's a whole argument whether or not Christ existed. I don't want to get into that right now either. But then the whole thing also comes down to, it appears as though Christ became more corrupted with and more emboldened by the more followers that he got. And on top of that, just looking at, I mean, well, first of all, when you read Bertrand Russell, he has an essay, Why I'm Not a Christian. He said that Christ was probably not the most ethical person because he promoted this idea of hell and this idea of eternal torment. And I think that's really interesting. Number one, that you can't truly be ethical if you promote destroying families like Christ did, to turn father against son, mother against daughter. But on top of that, reading the Sermon on the Mount, I did not like that at all. I thought that part of it was a good amount of filler material, a bunch of ambiguities that were just, you know, meaningless, pointless, like, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, you know?
I think this is the perfect time to plug Matt Dillahunty because, one, Matt on, I think it's Iron Chariots, the Iron Chariots wiki that he helped found, he has a very, very good dissection of Sermon on the Mount for anybody that wants to check that out. And tomorrow, Matt is going to be talking about this subject at great length and taking Q&A on it. And I've seen this lecture before, but
actually, he's reworking it just for us. It's brand new.
Oh, is it?
Well, one thing I wanted to say though is I'm a big proponent of free thought. And, you know, I like to consider myself a contagious free thinker. And one thing that gets me about this in the Sermon on the Mount, the one thing that I thought was the most abhorrent was this whole idea of if you look at someone with lust, you've already committed adultery in your heart. And there's something to be said about honesty, but at the same time, what Christ is complaining about is thought crimes. And I think we need to stand against... I haven't seen Dillahunty's commentary, but did Dillahunty mention anything about thought crimes there? Because that just seems exactly what that's about.
You know, I've only read his critique once.
Yeah.
He might have, but... yeah, I need to read it again. It's a very, very good dissection.
Yeah, well...
And, I mean, you know, Matt was quite a Jesus freak for 20-plus years, so...
Yeah.
And he was studying to become a minister, so he's quite well read and well versed on these subjects.
But I don't know. I don't know how chanting can necessarily make you a better person unless you're doing some kind of affirmation. But in that you're giving an affirmation to an external and fictitious being. You're not giving something good about yourself. And so, I don't know, there's just certain things to think about this, and I don't think any of them are good. Anyway, moving on to the next thing, Scientologists are facing fraud and extortion charges in Belgium, and again, more aid workers in Pakistan were murdered for distributing polio vaccines, and on and on and on. And the 113th Congress in, we reached a quasi-fiscal cliff deal. Hillary Clinton is recovering nicely from her clot. And, you know, Obama is doing signing statements, something that he said that he would never do, this time on the National Defense Authorization Act. And he, you know, I want to talk about this at a later time. I just want to bust through this podcast now. But, you know, what happens, I mean, there's three types of signing statements, rhetorical and constitutional, which are commentary, and political, which are the ones where the president defines how they're going to pursue particular legislation from Congress. They're allowed to define their role with Congress's legislation, which seems like it goes against the president's command in the second article of the Constitution to faithfully execute the laws of Congress. And I don't know, there's just too much to talk about this right now because I want to get through this, but we'll get to it eventually. But I think this is interesting that Obama is using signing statements, something that he said he wouldn't when he was running for office the first time. But then again, you know, he was saying that as a candidate, not a president. But then again, where are we in terms of consistency on this? It seems that if we would be against George, if we're liberal and we'd be against George W. Bush using signing statements, the whole unitary executive and all, where would we be if we would say, well, just let Obama do it, you know, when we would criticize Bush for doing it just because we like it? Why would, you know, where are we in terms of integrity and consistency if we are to grant greater flexibility for the things that we would like? Because that's, you know, that's the challenging thing about being moral and having integrity, is you have to grant sometimes less flexibility to things that you like in order to have consistency to protect and preserve the environment and the situation against things that you don't. And so with this, what Obama's doing is he said that his administration would not indefinitely detain, as a political commentary as in a signing statement, would not indefinitely detain American citizens without benefit or virtue of trial. And at the same time, he said that homophobic conscience clauses for military chaplains are quote-unquote ill-advised. The ill-advised would be a rhetorical signing statement. My administration will not be pursuing that is a political signing statement. So in that, I would say, because we should be sophisticated thinkers and not just black and white. There's a huge penumbra out there, a penumbric plethora of all sorts of gray areas and depths of the gray scale, and certain things that fall partially in the gray scale that we should look at things individually, but at the same time still have overriding ethical principles. So on this, I think that the president having some semblance of commentary, you know, we also have to think about to what extent does that affect Congress's power to legislate as well, if the president can just write a, you know, director's cut version of the law with every single thing. But at the same time, that might also bring up the point that there's a balance of powers, and that's the executive critique. But I don't know how I feel about political signing statements where the president says that they're going to do it, because that doesn't necessarily mean that the president will or won't follow through. What are your thoughts, Chris?
Well, I agree with that last part that political signing statements might be kind of pushing it, but I don't know. You could say that if a president feels a rhetorical signing statement is necessary, he's basically saying to the Congress, look, you guys wrote this legislation. This part of your proposed bill is kind of ambiguous. So I'm gonna say what I interpret it to mean and what I think about it.
That's actually the political one about the ambiguities.
Well,
but the president just doing the whole director's commentary, because he is the chief executive officer, that falls under the rhetorical one. But it's really interesting because when it comes to political, they got rid in a Supreme Court case of Clinton versus the city of New York. They got rid of line item vetoes. They found them unconstitutional. So in a sense, political signing statements are almost line item vetoes in a sense. But on top of that, the president also has vetoing authority. And so I don't know. I think this is interesting. I'm going to scoot ahead to the next one because I want to get this out of the way so we can, you know, have a great day tomorrow. And then I'm going to try to get a good interview with Matt Dillahunty while he's here. He doesn't have a lot of time, but hopefully we can have a few good minutes with him. And I'll get to that in a moment. A lot of gang rape stuff happening. Also, I thought that this was really interesting that the Netherlands had a huge crime wave several years ago. So they created enough penal institutions to house 14,000 inmates, but now they're down to 12,000, so they're going to be closing prisons because they don't have enough criminals. Convicts, rather. On top of the LGBT news, the first French baby of 2013 was born, and the French child had two mothers. And then the LGBT community is upset with what former Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel is going to be up for the defense secretary said about James Hormel when he was running for office, saying he was an aggressive homosexual. On top of this, last thing I want to get into is there was a study out by Brian Hare or Hare, I don't know how to pronounce that, of Duke University, and it was on bonobos. And it was about bonobos and sharing. And it turns out that bonobos, when being seen by others, will share with strangers before they'll share with bonobos and their bonobos familiar to them. And I'll just read the quotes that I copied and pasted that I just you know, ripped off of the article. This was on Science Daily, by the way, if you want to check it out. It was on bonobos and altruism. Most bonobos prefer to share with a stranger before an acquaintance. Bonobos try to extend their social network and apparently value that more than established relationships. Also, experiments involved piles of food and enclosures that the subjects were able to unlock and open. In one of the connected enclosures was a bonobo familiar with the first subject, and the second was a stranger. 9 out of 14 showed stranger preference, 3 none, and even when unable to procure food for themselves, while being watched, the bonobos would share the food with the stranger 9 times out of 10. The grad student, Mr. Tan, or Mrs. Tan, I don't have the first name, a certain grad student by the last name of Tan, said that by letting the third animal into the enclosure, the stranger voluntarily outnumbered himself or herself with two bonobos who knew each other, which a chimpanzee would never do. In 51 trials of the experiment, there was never any aggression shown, although there was quite a bit of typical bonobo genital rubbing between strangers. That's the thing about bonobos. Humans and chimps will go and kill each other for fun, but bonobos, on the other hand, will resolve situations with sex. According to Franz de Waal in his book The Age of Empathy, when there is a bit of social disharmony between two bands of bonobos, the females will go out and start having sex with bonobos of the other tribe. And what Franz de Waal says, it just comes to show that you can't go to war when everybody's too busy fucking. And lastly, in something called the dictator game, in which humans have a chance to share cash with a stranger, the human will often share anonymously, but not bonobos. They are more likely to share with strangers in front of others. They care about others, Hare said, or Hare said, but only in a sort of selfish way. They'll share when it's low-cost, low-benefit kind of situation. But when it's a no-benefit situation, they won't share. That's different from a human playing the dictator game. You really have to care about others to give anonymously. And I think that this is really interesting. And I wonder what would happen if we introduced bonobos to Whole Foods.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting, too. This, I think, lends support to your argument that humans are very altruistic and communitarian. I think bonobos are more of the libertarians' rational self-interest variety than humans are. I think, I know you really hate that term, Jason, but I think if we're going to use it, it'd be more appropriate to use it to describe the behaviors of bonobos than humans.
Yeah, and I think that that's true to an extent also right there about human beings, because we're more apt to give anonymously. But then again, we have to also talk about culture too when it comes to playing this. So I want to get to just some upcoming things. And we got some cool upcoming things that I think you guys are going to love. Of course, we just did our Voltaire meeting. I love Voltaire, and you should have been there. It was wonderful. We did Candide and God and Human Beings. And we're doing Christianity Unveiled and System of Nature this coming Tuesday. Following Tuesday, we have Coffee and Conversation next Saturday night, and I'm giving my annual What is Humanism chat, and I think you'll like it. I call it Humanism 101, not just popular atheism. And then February, the two books, Origin of Species, Descent of Man, Matt DeLonte in the Superiority of Secular Ethics tomorrow. And then on the first Thursday, I believe that's the 7th of February, we are talking about altruism in our monthly humanist ethics workshops. And that's going to be really cool. We had 20 people last time, and I hope we can double it because it's going to be awesome. And we're going to come out with a book on ethics. We're also going to do Inherit the Wind. We're probably going to do it as a reading rather than a full, acting with props performance. But still, if the acting bug has ever bit you, even if you've never done it before, we're going to need your help on that. More to come on that. And, lots of good stuff coming up. And this is our 13th podcast, which I think is awesome that we've made it through 13 of these already. And our 13th, for good luck, we have the San Diego Seculars rather than Secular. So yeah, thank you for joining us today. I don't know if I have time to edit by tomorrow, but I just want to get this out for everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Jason and
Chris. Thank you for having me, Jason.
Yes, and hopefully we can have you again sometime. Thank you so much. Absolutely. And I'm signing off. This has been a production of the Humanist Association of San Diego. Join us at Matt Dillahunty tomorrow. Bye.
Ciao.